Live from New York, it's The Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Got my mojo working, but just don't work on you.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null. Nice to have you with us today. We're going to give it into geoengineering, a special program. The disastrous consequences, the foolishness of it, but we're going to go into it in some depth from Prevent Disease, Kelly Bergman's report. We're also going to look at David Lindor's criticism of the Trans-Pacific Partnership. He says this is what corporatocracy looks like, trading U.S. democracy for corporate profits with the Trans-Pacific Partnership. Not to be outdone in his criticism, we also have Dave Johnson talking about Obama's Trans-Pacific Partnership promises, well, geez, what Bill Clinton promised on NAFTA. So we're going to go back and take a look at NAFTA, all the promises using actual quotes of President Clinton, and then showing you the truth of what happened. We're also going to look at the FDA caught in hiding 22 fraudulent studies. Why? We're going to look at corporate power grab, the wild claims of the, and the PR spin of the pro-GMO lobby, Colin Todhunter. We have that to share. I'm going to continue with my series on challenging American exceptionalism. I did some yesterday. Today I'll do more. From torture to drone assassination, how Washington gave itself a global get-out-of-jail-free card, the latest from Tom Dispatch, Alfred McCoy. Also, the way that the government watches us, and if we're not paying attention, we should be. John Whitehead wakes us up. Creepy, calculating, and controlling, all the ways Big Brother is watching you. But we always start with the latest on health and healing. One more reason why we should pay concern to children who are diagnosed with ADHD, because there's more and more evidence that it's all due, at least the legitimate diagnosis. A lot are not legitimate. If you have a kid going to school just absolutely sparked with caffeine and sugar, they're not going to be able to pay attention. They're not going to be able to sit still. But let's say you have a child that really does have a brain problem. Now we find from a pharmacist, Frank Granite, that it could be calcification of the pineal gland. Now, the brain is the most complex organ system of the human body, and with an intricate communication system involving neurological cells and chemical transmitters in the brain. Now, if these are supposed to work efficiently, and these are pulses, and these pulses allow normal behavior, but in today's very toxic environment, normal behavior development can be put at risk, and you can end up with symptoms like ADHD. And that's because of the chemicals in the food supply and the water supply. And those can end up impacting the pineal gland that plays a critical role in the enzyme pathway for the production of brain neurotransmitters, including serotonin and norepinephrine. Additionally, the body's antioxidant defense system is optimized by healthy pineal gland tissue, which help eliminate free radical toxins that accumulate in the body. By the way, the pineal gland is very small. It's only about 7 millimeters. And so you need to understand that when a child is given sugar, including in its baby bottle, glucose water, which is very dangerous, then given all these foods that have artificial sweeteners, salts, and chemicals, that is affecting the pineal gland. So it's not the only cause, but it's certainly one of the causes, and that can cause calcification of the pineal gland. So get rid of all sugar, no fluoride in the water supply at all, get rid of fluoride in any toothpaste, and that's very important. And also, 1 teaspoon of cold apple cider vinegar can, in water, once a day, and it contains malic acid, decalcifies the pineal gland. So that's important as well. Now, there's a lot of debate about what we should start our day with. Well, here's what we ideally should. We should have a breakfast that provides energy, a lunch that's your largest meal of the day, and a small, low-energy dinner. For diabetics, that's the best thing you can do because, according to the Journal of the European Association for the Study of Diabetes, that will help maintain good blood sugar levels. There was research done at Tel Aviv University, as well as Lund University in Sweden, where they came up with this concept. Now, imagine that you had been using some of the advice I shared about how to start the day. Let's say that you started with organic steel-cut oats. Now, that's different from the instant oat flakes, which I don't recommend. This, when you cook at low temperature water, takes about 5 minutes, but it's very gooey. It's almost... let's say it's almost as if you have to really chew it. And then you add in a nut butter at the end of it, like an almond butter or cashew butter, and then some plant-based protein and some berries and a handful of pomegranates would be good, a teaspoon of coconut butter. You're going to be able to stabilize your blood sugar for about 5 hours, 4 to 5 hours. And that would be terrific. And you could do the same thing with a smoothie. But that will really help you. And then if you're having your starchy vegetables and your beans in particular at lunch, and sea vegetables would help your thyroid gland, and that also helps give you the iodine that you need, all that is helping fortify you. And then in the evening, about 4 o'clock, your body begins to slow down. I'm sure many of you have found that around 4 o'clock you get a little tired, want to take a nap, and you just want to take a break when you get home from work. But what we do, we artificially stimulate ourselves. The hint, the caffeine, the so-called energy drinks, and sugar, which will, for a period of time, boost your energy, but at enormous cost to the body. So if you have a light meal and with a light amount of protein, let's say 15 grams of protein, you could have an energy shake that you can make yourself. Or you could have, like, avocado salad, which would be good, and with some beans. By the way, one of the beans that have the most protein, well, the most protein is in your organic soybeans, but also kidney beans and pinto beans are very good. And you can mash them up and add in whatever seasoning you like. And it's always nice to put a little bit of a natural relish, and there's natural relishes you can buy at the farmer's market, and it gives it a wonderful flavor, and you put that in. Or you might have some brown rice you made, a whole bowl, and you eat a little bit each day. And so you put your brown rice into a salad, and you can put some lemon juice. Always put lemon juice over brown rice in a salad, and then some olive oil, and then some Himalayan sea salt, black pepper, and then whatever else you're putting in the salad to make it interesting. I'll tell you something that's really cool is you have your salad with microgreens and sprouts and lettuce, and put in some hearts of palm and some Jerusalem artichoke, and then have that lump of brown rice in, well, about what would be a cupful, which is a serving. And in that, put in some raw pomegranate seeds and then put relish and stir the two together. Then put that in the middle of your salad. And if you're treating someone to a salad, they won't expect that, the taste. And always have some blanched, which means you steam them, then pour cold water and put them in the fridge, asparagus, broccoli, Brussels sprouts, and cauliflower. Add that in as well. And a nice treat is simply to take some broccoli crowns. So what you do, you put your water on. You can do it either in a wok steaming basket, or you can just boil some water and then turn off the water heat and just put the whole crown upside down so the stem is sticking up, but the crown is down in the water for about 3 minutes. Take it out, run cold water over it, and then cut that, the stem off. Now you have maybe 7 to 10 little crown, bite-sized pieces. And then you put lemon juice on that with some olive oil and pink Himalayan sea salt. That is a delicious treat in a salad or a snack throughout the day. Anyhow, the idea is have your protein 3 times a day. And the older you get, over the age of 40, make sure that you're getting enough protein. Most people don't. That's why their muscles begin to sag. They lose their libido, and in men in particular, human growth hormone. A new study out of the University of Georgia shows why exercise reduces stress. A group of neuroscientists found that when we work out in the gym, it not only improves our ability to preserve through hard times. In a series of recent experiments, neuroscientists have begun to unravel the link between long-term stress, resilience, and exercise. It was published in the journal Neuropharmacology and reveals that neuropeptide called galanin is a necessary piece of the puzzle. Researchers demonstrated that in this particular model, the galanin protects neurons from degeneration caused by stress. Remember, every time you stress, legitimately or not, you end up destroying your brain cells. But when you exercise, that exercise changes the biochemistry and decreases the exposure to this process. So every time you exercise, in effect, you're protecting your brain from stress. Also, we now know from a study in Sweden at Lund University that the signal molecule retinoic acid is a product of vitamin A, which helps to instruct how different types of tissue are to be formed in the growing embryo. And for the first time, they studied the effects of retinoic acid in relation to how blood cells develop from human stem cells. And in the laboratory model, the stem cells are exposed to specific signal molecules. I don't want to make it too complicated. It's just that we should be paying a lot more attention to having orange, red, green, and yellow vegetables and juices, because it's helping our blood cells, it's helping our DNA, it's helping our stem cells, it helps everything. And most people are not aware of that. Now, people know that when they eat chili peppers, it can be hot, sometimes excruciatingly hot. That kind of hot also creates in the body a healthy burn. Now, what do I mean by that? Well, I know friends that can eat really hot. I don't like really hot. I like spicy, but I don't like hot spicy. Mild. And in some Indian places, they'll actually explain, you know, do you want a light, medium, or hot? All of it does something good to the body. I'm not talking about irritating the tongue and lining of the mouth. So you have to have, a couple glasses of water. The jalapeno peppers are hot. But by the way, jalapeno are not the hottest pepper. What do you think is the hottest pepper? Just think for a moment. Okay, the hottest pepper is the Carolina Reaper. Hottest pepper in the world. And they're rich in beta-carotene and vitamin C and fiber. And by the way, peppers, mildly hot, are also good for different types of birds and primates. And they can help cleanse parasites out of the body. Now, what makes a pepper good and why we should be having a lot more of them is what is called capsaicin. Cap, C-P, say, S-A-I, sin, C-I-N, capsaicin. It has anti-cancer properties. And therefore, it's very good, especially at killing pancreatic carcinoma cells, cultured, and it can wipe them out. So that's important. It aids weight loss. In fact, it can cause up to an 8% decrease in body weight. It alleviates pain, which is primarily what it's used for in the United States, topical agents for arthritis and bursitis and fibromyalgia. You'll have a cream with it in it, and it works. There are hundreds of studies on that. I found that it works when given to people who need to improve sleep, overcome fatigue and depression, and those who have post-herpetic neuralgia, and sometimes HIV neuropathy. Very good. And so that's why it's so good. So even though it may be a little warm in your mouth, inside it can also thin your blood, and it can kill parasites. A new study from University of North Carolina shows that antibiotics are being given so frequently that they're increasing antibiotic resistance, and you're getting a whole new bunch of bacteria that are not easy to kill. So my suggestion to the public health officials listening, we have nurses and physicians listening, is always try the least problematic to the body. Like get wild oregano oil with pau d'arco and olive leaf extract and the best honey that there is at the highest dose. Now, that would be Manuka, M-A-N-U-K-A. But there are different grades of Manuka honey. If I'm counseling someone who's really sick and I'm going to give them not a 5 or a 10, I'm going to give them a 550. That is, it has the highest healing capacity. It's expensive. I recently, on my trip, I want to make sure I had Manuka honey. And so I got one from a health food store, and it was $90 for a little jar, 8 ounces. But it was 550, the highest there is. So this way, when I'm taking an herbal tea and I have a teaspoon of that Manuka honey, I know how much good it's doing, killing bacteria and viruses in the throat, in the intestine. So that's what we should be doing first. And see if we can help people overcome antibiotic needs instead of just loading people up. Also, giving people probiotics is important because antibiotics just destroy all of the good bacteria, and bad bacteria multiply. In fact, there was a whole report on this in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences that talked about this. They ended up stimulating a biofilm, and you need healthy bacteria. And the production of biofilms is not a side effect at all, suggesting that bacteria may have evolved to produce antibiotics in order to produce biofilms, and not only for their killing abilities. Biofilms, by the way, B-I-O-F-I-L-M-S, these are communities of bacteria that form on surfaces, a phenomenon dentists usually refer to as plaque. And biofilms are everywhere. In many cases, biofilms can be beneficial, such as when they protect plant roots from pathogens, but they can also be harmful, for instance, when they form on medical catheters or feeding tubes in patients, causing disease. So the more antibiotics you have, the more these are going to be created, and the less good bacteria you're going to have. So make sure you're getting your probiotics in there as well, especially if someone has had any of the antibiotics. And finally, I read an interesting article by Peter Byron from Prevent Disease about breast cancer money in the media and how breast cancer statistics are being manipulated. I've known this because I just finished a film on cancer and a book on cancer. But the average person isn't out there doing this research. For example, out in the Pacific, on the West Coast, women, and I was just out there, women believe that they're part of an unexplained breast cancer cluster. It's a fear created by media hype and medical researchers, and that's doing the women a disservice. So for all of our listeners, and I have a lot of listeners out there in California, especially up around San Francisco, and a specific area, Marin, M-A-R-I-N, Marin County. It's across the, on the other side of the bay. You are told you have the highest rate of cancer in the country, and up around 35% higher than the national average. It's not true. You've been lied to. And all you have to do is just look at each part of this construct and see how women in the wealthiest communities are targeted in such a way that they have the wherewithal and the means to go in to get breast screening. Now, look at who's behind this game. AstraZeneca, Avon, Chevron, Baker Hughes. These are the people who dominate the research agenda. So what makes it seem like you have a higher rate of breast cancer than those women in less affluent communities is that you have the money and you have the will and the education to say, I don't want to have breast cancer, so I'm going to go have a mammography. Well, mammographies end up causing more women to die of cancers than those that are detected from them. And because more affluent women have more mammograms than women of less access to wealth and health care, the excessive use of mammograms increases the number of small cancer detected. But most of those are not really cancers. They're ductile. They're not going to become cancer and kill you, the vast majority. But they're still counted as if it was a cancer. And it also increases the number of false positives and the results in the treatment of non-cancerous tissues. Simply put, overdiagnosis leads to overtreatment, subjecting women to surgery, radiation, and chemical toxins that cause painful side effects. And that is where they came up with that. So there's a lot that we can do, including showing women the truth about anti-cancer protocols. What causes cancer? Inflammation that impacts the gene. Well, what are the things that cause inflammation? Alcohol, caffeine, sugar, artificial sweeteners, cooked the way we cook it in America, overcooked in high heat, food, any form of cooked carbohydrate, acrylamides, any form of cooked meat. It creates heterocyclic amines, alcohol. Now, the more affluent a person is, the more likely they are to imbibe in social drinking. And look at the ads on television, especially the one that really is strange, is the vodka commercials, because vodka has no taste, none. So they try to make people think that you're really hip and you're really, you know, sophisticated, and especially if you're young and in your 20s and educated and wealthy, then you got to be drinking this in order just to keep that image going. You could drink some ice water. Nobody would know the difference. It's all just a game. Everything is a game to commodify you. But it causes cancer. It causes the destruction of about a million cells in the brain, kidney, liver, and heart per drink. So if you only want to socialize and have one drink, you're probably knocking 10 to 15 years off your life. So once you start realizing, what if we had parties where people didn't have to have alcohol and could have non-alcoholic beverages, and instead of all the bad food, had healthy food and exercise and de-stress, clean your environment? That's what prevents cancer, but there's no money in that. But I wanted to share that with you. We're just going to take a moment to offer you something special that I have not offered in the past. And the reason I'm offering this is because there's currently a major controversy. The controversy is our freedom to choose the vaccines that we wish, or not at all, for ourselves or for our children. The government, the state agencies, the federal agencies, the scientists for hire, the hired guns of the medical and scientific establishment all say you should have no choice. Vaccines are safe and effective. Anyone who challenges that is a quack, a person who is irresponsible. You're putting the rest of the community at risk because your child or you are not vaccinated. Hence, we mandate vaccines. They even want to go so far, and these are people on the left, the liberal establishment, The Nation magazine, Mother Jones, MSNBC, Rachel Maddow, Bill Maher, It seems like everyone on the left believes that you should take your vaccines, they're safe and effective, and you're irresponsible if you don't. Some people in the media have even suggested that parents who refuse to vaccinate their children should be put in jail, and those children should be taken away by the state and vaccinated and put into foster homes. That's how extreme this contentious issue has become. Herein is the problem. For those parents, and there are more than 2 million parents who have injured children, over a million children suffering with autism spectrum disorder, others suffering from hyperactivity and brain damage and learning disabilities due to vaccines, they've done their homework. These are not compliant drones. These are extremely well-educated individuals who wanted to know, how did a normal, healthy, developing child stop developing and recede? Clearly, there are environmental issues. Not every child receiving vaccines will end up injured. Some are able to tolerate it because they're not as genetically susceptible. Others are. The trouble is that the vaccine ingredients are themselves all toxic. Aluminum is neurotoxic. Mercury, extremely neurotoxic, in parts per billion, which are in all the vaccines. They only took the microgram amounts out, except for the flu vaccine, but the parts per billion are still left in. Formaldehyde, embalming fluid, polysorbate 80, fetal cells, contaminants. Every vaccine in the world is contaminated with DNA. And yet, we've been given assurances they're safe. They're not. We've been given assurances they work. Then why is it then in a recent group of children fully vaccinated for measles, some came down with measles, and those who were fully vaccinated against chickenpox came down with chickenpox? In fact, if you really believe that the vaccines worked, then you shouldn't be concerned about those who are not vaccinated because you're protected. But then you're not. Lies and deceptions. Over the last 6 years, I have produced 3 multi-award-winning documentaries on this topic. I have sought out those scientists who have no financial conflict of interest, have no ideological or political biases, who simply are good quality scientists, public health educators, board-certified pediatricians, looking for the truth. My newest film, The Silent Epidemic, released just this year, Autism Made in USA, and going back a little further, Vaccine Nation. We are offering all 3 of these as a package. Now, normally this would cost you $120. It's only $59.95. So you're saving an awful lot of money. You're saving almost, $60? So $59.95 for 3 very important, extremely empowering and educational films about vaccines, telling you the truth about them. So I'm going to give you a number to call, and you can order them. They'll be sent right out to you. Watch them. Share them with people. Let people who believe in vaccines, let them watch these, because these are not misinformed, radicalized people. These are extremely informed people. And we go through the cover-ups, we go through the whistleblowers within the CDC who have told you the truth that the vaccine trials on autism were fraudulent and the figures were rigged. We tell you the truth. Brian Wims was recently disgraced when it was uncovered that he had been lying about him being in a near-fatal helicopter accident. Then it turned out that they're now questioning other things he has said. And he lost his reputation. What was amazing is the people who were saying that he shouldn't be trusted with the very people who we trusted to tell us the truth about weapons of mass destruction in Iraq and Saddam Hussein and 9/11 and him supporting Al-Qaeda, none of which were true. So it's not just Brian Williams who should not be believed or trusted. It is the entire media. They have lied to us constantly about everything, and especially on public health issues. And they all are lying about vaccines, safety and efficacy, and only having on those people who have financial ties to the vaccine industry. Now you'll learn the truth. Three multi-award-winning documentaries about the truth about vaccine safety and efficacy. Call 877-627-5065. 877-627-5065. 877-627-5065. And ask for your copy of three different documentaries. The Vaccine Package, Autism Made in USA, The Silent Epidemic, and Vaccine Nation. 877-627-5065. I want to share something with you on geoengineering. This is a report from Prevent Disease from Kelly Bergman. Because a lot of people in this audience have asked me about geoengineering, and I've done at least four major one-hour programs on the topic. The point is this. Large-scale geoengineering programs are underway in what is claimed to prevent catastrophic global warming. However, not only are these initiatives ineffective, but they could have severe unintended effects upon the Earth's climate. How so? You might know it by a different word. Maybe it's not geoengineering, but chemtrails, or aerial spraying, or aerosol emissions, or serious clouds. The largest reports come from Canada and the United States, but it happens all over the world, including countries like France, Germany, New Zealand, Australia, and the United Kingdom. Thousands of planes spray chemicals, and this is particulate matter, into our atmosphere, they say, in order to curb global warming. I don't believe them. And also, I believe that what happens is, like all bureaucracies and private contracts, once you're in that loop, you just get refunded every single year, always for more. So it doesn't matter if what you were doing was something temporary, it becomes permanent. All these massive bureaucracies become self-serving and permanent. I believe this is one more of those cases where maybe at some point someone had an idea that might have made sense, but long ago they should have been stopped and refunded. They're not. The government around the world claim research into deliberately interfering with the climate system must continue in searching for technologies to use as the last resort in combating climate change. That's one way of looking at it. Closing down all of Coke industries and any other polluting industry would be another way of looking at it, and immediately having a Marshall Plan worldwide for wave power, which is completely non-polluting, and geothermal, which is non-polluting, and wind, which is somewhat polluting, but it's also destructive to millions upon millions of birds and noise. But if it's at sea or high up in the mountains where it could be put, especially at the Great Divide, the Continental Divide up in Colorado, then it would be beneficial. And, of course, solar. Though it takes energy to create the solar panel, once it's created, there's an enormous payback to the environment. So that's another way of looking at it, instead of just continuing to do stupid spraying in the skies. Science academics around the world, as well as some climate activists, have called for more research into geoengineering techniques, such as reflecting sunlight from space, adding vast quantities of lime or iron filings into the ocean, pumping deep, cold, nutrient-rich waters to the surface of the oceans, or irrigating vast areas of North Africa and Australian deserts. I find all those just foolish. The most proliferating geoengineering techniques are focused on ways of reducing the sun's rays by blocking them spraying chemical compounds into the atmosphere, is what is claimed to reflect sunlight away from the Earth. Researchers have debunked the claim simply by looking at simple energy balance analysis to explain how the Earth's water cycle responds differently to heating by sunlight than it does to warming due to a stronger atmospheric greenhouse effect. So that doesn't work. It's called global dimming, and it's the gradual reduction in the amount of global direct irradiance at the Earth's surface that was observed for several decades after the start of the systematic measurements in the 1950s. And the effect varies by location, but worldwide, it's been estimated to be in the order of about 5% reduction over the three decades from 1960 to 1990, and another 15 to 17% reduction from 1990 to the present. And much of the dimming is being blamed on geoengineering. As a consequence, many populations in parts of the Earth are receiving substantially less vitamin D over a yearly period. And you've heard me mention many times on this program, we need vitamin D every day. So global security and health will be threatened unless an international treaty is developed to oversee any sun-blocking projects. And the researchers are showing that this difference implies that reflecting sunlight to reduce temperatures may have unwanted effects on the Earth's rainfall patterns. The results were now published in Earth Systems Dynamics, which is an open-access journal of the European Geoscience Union. Artificial weather modification can impact all of us by reducing water supplies, changing agricultural crop production and cycles, reducing crop production and water availability. And since most experimental weather modification programs use chemicals released into the atmosphere, the public could be subjected increasingly to toxic or unknown substances that could adversely impact agriculture and humans. If we artificially change the growing seasons, our pollinators, like bees and birds, now in sharp decline, over 50% died in the last 10 years, and one-third of all the crops we use in the United States require these pollinators, these are not going to survive. Now, I'm a certified organic farmer. I'm a beekeeper. I've had as many as 144 hives, as few as one. And in all these decades of owning bees, I never take the honey from them, or propolis, or pollen. I just enjoy seeing the phenomena of pollination, because without them, you see a tremendous difference. You could see fruit trees that won't bear fruit for 5 or 10 years. You get bees and suddenly they produce fruit, all type of phenomena. And it's just a matter of knowing what they need, living in balance with them. So if you go changing their environment, if it gets too cold, they'll die. Gets too hot, they'll die. If it's too rainy, they don't like going out of the hive. All kinds of things that you can do when you start interfering with the environment. In fact, researchers at Helmholtz Center for Ocean Research in Kiel, Germany, modeled 5 potential methods and concluded that geoengineering could add chaos to complex and not fully understood weather systems, even when applied on a massive scale. The most that could be expected, they say, is a temperature drop of about 8%. The potential side effects would be potentially disastrous. Now, they write in the major journal Nature Communications, ocean upwelling, or bringing up the deep cold waters, would cool surface water temperatures and reduce sea ice melting, but could unbalance the global heat budget, while adding iron fillings or lime would affect the oxygen levels in the ocean. Reflecting the sun's rays into space would alter rainfall patterns, and reforesting the deserts could change wind patterns and could even reduce tree growth in other regions. Scientists think they can optimally fertilize the ocean artificially to help restore lost threatened ecosystems. Well, dropping iron filings into the ocean could theoretically generate blooms of carbon-absorbing plankton. The plankton then take the CO2 at the surface, then carry it with them as they drift to the ocean floor after death, creating carbon sinks. This theoretically assumes iron infusions could preferentially favor certain species and alter surface ecosystems, even though they have no evidence, none, zero, zip, on the overall impact, since the effects are unknown. Population explosion of aquatic life that disturb the food chain may impact many wildlife populations. This has already been shown to lead to an unnatural imbalance of fish, whales, and jellyfish. The study showed that iron enrichment stimulates toxic diatom production in high nitrate, low chlorophyll areas, which the authors argue raises serious concerns over the net benefit and sustainability of large-scale iron fertilizations. It takes a long time for comparatively little effect. So we find that if solar radiation management or ocean upwelling is discontinued, then rapid warming occurs. If the other methods are discontinued, less dramatic changes occur. Essentially, all CO2 that was taken up remains in the ocean. So even the foresting of deserts on a massive scale could prove disastrous if the irrigation needed to grow the trees were stopped. The desert regions would eventually return to desert, and the carbon that was stored in the plant biomass and soil would slowly be returned to the atmosphere through decay and respiration. So you have scientists who don't always think of the consequences of what they create. And we're not thinking, and we should. What if we did this? What if to help put people back to work and to stimulate proper infrastructure, we began to have plantings of trees and shrubs and wind barriers in all the states in America? We could put 1 million people to work at a living wage, and we could cause carbon sinks, and we could help the desertification of much of the midsection of the country. But we're not doing that, and we should. Now, I'm concerned, as I know many of you are, about mandatory vaccines. If you choose to get a vaccine, that's your choice. But at least look at all the information and not just the talking points, because you could end up in serious trouble. In New York Assembly, they're sponsors of a human papillomavirus mandate bill. Now, to understand why I'm opposed to the human papillomavirus, you would just go to my archives and listen to this past Tuesday's one-hour special with 4 scientists, all really good, knowledgeable on the topic, who published papers on this, on the human papillomavirus and why it's a fraud. But the industry, the most expensive vaccine out there, most profitable vaccine out there, why the politicians side with the manufacturers and the lobbyists, and why the media, and most of the media, 80% of all the media in America is controlled by 6 corporations, and they have a pro-vaccine approach, because they also are in the pharmaceutical business. So I've written Assemblywoman Paulin a letter, and I will read it to you now. Dear Assemblywoman Paulin, we are writing to express our opposition to the New York State Assembly Bill 1822 that would mandate the human papillomavirus vaccines in New York State children starting in the 6th grade. Given the human papillomavirus vaccine's poor record of efficacy and safety, a mandate for these vaccines that are legally defined as, quote, unavoidably unsafe, end quote, would be an irresponsible decision with dire long-term consequences for the future well-being and health of the state's children and their families. New York has attempted to mandate questionable vaccines in the past. In 2009, we submitted a 94-page white paper to Governor David Paterson and the New York State health officials providing the scientific evidence and rationale against mandating the H1N1 influenza vaccine to healthcare workers. You recall at the time, the presiding New York State Health Commissioner, Dr. Richard Daines, withdrew mandate efforts only hours after it was publicly revealed that his wife was a managing director at Goldman Sachs. It was discovered that Dr. Daines was not acting on behalf of the public health of citizens, but through a serious conflict of corporate interest. Goldman Sachs was heavily invested in underwriting one of the H1N1 flu vaccines being recommended by New York State. Today, Gardasil maker Merck's efforts to influence state legislators to mandate their vaccine is common knowledge. Merck's lobbying for Gardasil mandates has been observed in other states, especially in Governor Perry's administration in Texas. And it's no secret that you're also receiving donations from Merck for your election campaign. As of 2014, with only 57% vaccination rate for girls and 35% rate for boys, the human papillomavirus vaccines, along with the influenza vaccine, hold the lowest level of confidence among the American public. It is unconscionable that New York State government would step in to enforce a vaccine the public clearly does not want nor feels it needs. Gardasil was fast-tracked for approval through the FDA and therefore bypassed the standard rigid federal review to ascertain its efficacy and safety. Many thousands of girls and young women have suffered sudden collapse and seizures within hours of vaccination. Disability fatigue, facial paralysis, brain inflammation, rheumatoid arthritis, lupus, blood clots, multiple sclerosis, strokes, and death have been problems associated with Gardasil. As of 2013, there were 29,918 adverse Gardasil reports, including 140 deaths in the federal government's vaccine adverse events reporting. For GlaxoServerX, there were 2,652 reported vaccine injuries, including 13 deaths. According to the CDC's own admission, only 10% of vaccine adverse events are reported to the VAERS data system. Consequently, the actual number of vaccine injuries is substantially higher. These statistics alone should warn you and the bill's co-sponsors against mandating these vaccines. All vaccines are legally classified as, by the federal government, quote, unavoidably unsafe. What distinguishes the very different vaccines are their rates of adverse events and the severity of the injuries each afflicts. In this regard, the human papillomavirus vaccines most threaten the health and lives of its recipients. Negligent denial of the peer-reviewed medical literature providing conclusive evidence of human papillomavirus vaccine's serious health risk is no excuse for pushing a bill, A-1822. India has banned human papillomavirus vaccine trials. Japan has halted the administration of Gardasil for safety reasons. South Africa launched an effort to investigate the boom in adverse vaccine injuries after the licensure of Gardasil. France has banned human papillomavirus vaccine ads due to false claims. Spain has recalled human papillomavirus vaccines, and Israel is now considering a national ban. And now, more recent scientific investigation provides us with further information that should not only put a full stop to any efforts to mandate the human papillomavirus vaccines, but to remove them from the market altogether. Research carried out by doctors Christopher Shaw and doctors Lucicia Tomjinkovic at the University of British Columbia on brain tissue of two New Zealand teenage girls who died shortly after receiving Gardasil identified the vaccine's viral antigen as a causal factor resulting in brain hemorrhaging contributing to the girls' deaths. This would also account for the innumerable instances of human papillomavirus vaccine recipients experiencing loss of consciousness, seizures, neurological injuries following human papillomavirus vaccination. Human papillomavirus vaccine injuries today far exceed the number of cervical cancer cases that can be accurately attributed to wild human papillomavirus, the papillomavirus infection. It is therefore clear there is no substantive reason to conclude that the benefits of the human papillomavirus vaccine outweigh its risks. A recent study out of the University of California, Berkeley, quote, individual karyotypes at the origins of cervical carcinomas, end quote, and published in the journal Molecular Cytogenetics, has raised a serious dilemma that the human papillomavirus may not be a primary cause of cervical cancer. And while the study remains preliminary, if the findings are true, then a vaccine against the virus would provide no protection and only compromise the girls and boys susceptible to the vaccine's dangers. It should be evident that more serious research needs to be undertaken before the draconian law to mandate the human papillomavirus vaccine for all sixth graders is implemented in New York. If the state of New York mandates the human papilloma vaccine, and in the future it is ascertained that the vaccine is in fact the cause of countless vaccine injuries in young adults, the sponsors of this bill and yourself potentially, countless girls and boys will be accountable for the failing health and deaths of potentially countless boys and girls. Sorry. You will also be held accountable for many New York families suffering the cost to provide care to vaccine-injured children for the remainder of their lives. Therefore, we urgently request that you and your co-sponsors of A-1822 act upon the precautionary principle and refrain from politicizing the human papillomavirus vaccine and supporting the bill. I hosted this past Tuesday a broadcast over the Progressive Radio Network with a panel of experts, including physicians and academic immunologists, to deconstruct and lay bare the fallacies in the government and Merck's propaganda supporting the human papillomavirus vaccines. I invite you to listen to this broadcast from the archives. I also taken the privilege of sending your office a copy of recent documentary Silent Epidemic, The History, Hidden History of Vaccines, to counter the myths of vaccines' efficacy and safety. The film includes a segment devoted specifically to the human papilloma vaccines. In the meantime, I welcome the opportunity to speak with you and any of the Assembly Bill's co-sponsors if there are questions regarding the efficacy and safety of Gardasil or Cervarix to be answered. Sincerely yours, Gary Knoll, Ph.D., and Richard Gale, executive producer. And that is what I've sent. On behalf of the parents, the girls and boys of New York State, so that we don't have another one of these politicizing of a public health issue and the media supporting it without doing their homework, which they almost never do. By the way, I just read this early this morning. This is from California. Parents in California are distraught after losing their infant son after being vaccinated. He died in his sleep and was taken to the hospital already deceased. Hospital staff ruled his death as sudden infant death syndrome. The couple was told an autopsy would be required. After returning home, waiting for an update, they never received one. Numerous phone calls were made. Weeks went by. Finally, they received verbal confirmation they could pick up the remains of their child from the crematorium. They were not given a chance to say their goodbyes. More than a year and 4 months have passed, and the family has yet to receive his autopsy report. It turns out their son was given a vaccine not approved for his age and an extra dose of the hepatitis B vaccine that shouldn't have been received. That's just one of the horror stories we hear. This is from testimony last week from Dr. Paul Thomas, and board-certified pediatrician. Let me, from Health Impact News, let me share this. It's short but important. Dr. Paul Thomas in Oregon, prior to testifying in a committee hearing on proposed bill SB 442 to remove vaccine exemptions for children. And Dr. Paul Thomas has a master's degree in biology and MD from Dartmouth Medical School, completed his pediatric residency at the University of California, San Diego. He's a board-certified fellow of the American Academy of Pediatrics, also carries board certifications in addiction medicine and integrative holistic medicine. And he is obviously knowledgeable in the area of immunization. As a practicing pediatrician, currently one of the few actual board-certified fellows of the American Academy of Pediatrics residing in the state of Oregon, he took time out to go to the hearings and on this particular bill. Quote, "This bill is a travesty." Dr. Paul then stated why this bill is such a travesty. Quote, "This is powerful. This is important. This is for our children. We need to protect our children and preserve the right of freedom of choice and the right to give informed consent when your child is about to get a vaccine." Then Dr. Thomas began his testimony by stating he represents, quote, 11,000 patients and 500 new babies come into his practice each month wanting informed consent at his clinic about vaccines. Meaning informed consent, the risks, the benefits, and alternatives. And he states that it is his responsibility as a physician to point out the risks and benefits of every medical procedure, but that this proposed bill would not allow him to do this for any patients. Dr. Paul addresses the hepatitis B vaccine routinely given to newborn babies in the hospitals. He states that the amount of aluminum contained in this vaccine is 1,500% above the allowable for infants. He provides then handouts to each committee member showing the peer-reviewed studies linking aluminum exposure to brain damage and autism. And they're all from peer-reviewed journals. I won't go through them, but they're all in what he gave. According to Dr. Paul, the only people who need the hepatitis vaccine are moms who are positive for hepatitis B, which is less than 1% in Oregon and the rest of the country. Quote, so we're going to poison the other 99%, and it's going to be mandated by this law so that we cover that 1%, and our OGBYNs are doing a masterful job. We know who needs a vaccine and who doesn't. Dr. Paul also pointed out a study conducted in Norway that followed 85,000 pregnancies over 6 years, which tracked folate intake in autism. This was published in the Journal of the American Medical Association, the title, Association Between Maternal Use of Folic Acid Supplements and Risk of Autism Spectrum Disorder in Children. Norway only had 1 in 1,000 rate of autism. 1 in 1,000. In the United States, it's 1 in 55. As Dr. Paul looked for the differences in newborn pediatric care between the U.S. and Norway, he noticed that Norway does not give the hepatitis B vaccine at birth like the U.S. does. He then made the stunning statement that in his practice, he currently has over 1,000 kids at least 3 years old that are, and there are no new cases of autism, which nationally his peers in pediatric are seeing 1 in 50 on the autism. And he tells the committee that we can greatly reduce the rate of autism by understanding that increased vaccines are in fact correlated with increased rates of autism. He referenced a 2004 CDC study that supposedly showed no link, but which now is known to show an increased link in autism in African-American boys of 300%. And Dr. Paul ended his brief testimony before the committee by stating, quote, science is not settled, linking vaccines to autism, and we need more studies. So, that's what we're not hearing in mainstream media. I was not able to get to everything else I wanted to today, including my continuing series on America, the police state, and fascism, and Too Big to Fail. But I will do that on upcoming programs, as well as information on the Trans-Pacific Partnership and why we should be concerned about it. We have a lot to share, as I told you at the beginning of the program. Going to be an awful lot of material today, but there is tomorrow, and we will share it tomorrow. I want to thank you all for listening. Have a nice day.